It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with an advocate working to end gender violence among Southeast Asian communities here in Wisconsin.
First, President Trump is on the tail end of his Asia trip. Today, he touted a, quote, great relationship with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte in Manila.
Duterte is a controversial figure in the international community. He's been frequently criticized by human rights advocates for his bloody anti-drug campaign in the Philippines. President Trump's friendly rapport with Duterte has raised eyebrows, especially after he invited him to visit the U.S. back in April.
Josh Kurlinsik is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So President Trump's warm rapport with President Duterte has raised some eyebrows, especially when he invited Duterte to the U.S. to visit earlier this year. Why does Trump's relationship with Duterte concern critics?
Because Duterte has, in the past year, overseen a brutal and relatively lawless drug war in the Philippines, in which he's unleashed the police and perhaps vigilantes to kill thousands of suspected drug users and others.
And so, with that that anti-drug campaign that he has, been behind, what has been the reaction in the Philippines to that move?
Well, I would say actually, at first there was strong public support because Duterte was a very popular politician. As the drug war has gone on, some of the abuses have been captured on camera. Juveniles have been captured being killed extrajudicially. There was no clear endpoint. Public reaction has softened somewhat, and there has been some pushback from the public as well as from some influential leaders in the Catholic Church and others.
So at the gala yesterday, and this has been one of the things that has been making the rounds, Duterte sang along to a popular Filipino love song with the lyric, I believe the translation is along the lines of, "You are the light in my world, a half of this heart of mine." And he said it was at Trump's request. What sort of signal does that send about what looks like a friendly relationship?
I don't know. Duterte is very theatrical. I wouldn't put too much into that. I think the more important issues are not really whether Duterte sang Trump a song or the personal relationship between the two of them, but whether the U.S. and the Philippines are actually making progress on important issues or not, including human rights, strategic issues, economic issues, etc. But, Duterte is a very outspoken person. So the fact that he sang a song for Trump, I wouldn't read too much into that.
And, we already sort of went a little bit into the bloody anti-drug campaign, and Duterte has been criticized not just in his country, but among Western leaders as well. Do you think that President Trump could alienate himself by developing strong ties with Duterte?
I don't think he has the greatest relationship with a lot of other Western leaders anyway, and it's of a piece with the Trump administration's basically downgrading of human rights, period, in U.S. foreign policy, which I think is hugely problematic in Asia and other parts of the world. I don't think Trump's going to alienate himself from other Western leaders simply by embracing Duterte. They're concerned about a lot of things about Trump. This would be a small factor.
Josh Kurlinsik is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's with us right now to talk about President Trump's trip to Asia. He has been in the Philippines, and one of the things that has come up is the relationship between Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte and President Trump. And, Duterte is not an unknown figure for many Americans. He had kind of a tricky relationship with President Trump's predecessor, President Obama. What reputation has he built among his own people there?
Duterte came into office he won a multiple way election, but he came into office as a kind of populist attempting to be both, bring in both new ideas on economics. He had a left-leaning background, as well as sort of break the control of a small number of people in Manila who have dominated Philippine politics for decades. And so he was the mayor of a town and a city in the southern Philippines. So that was popular, as well as his sort of like take no prisoner style was popular. The Philippines has weak political parties, so there wasn't much they could do to constrain him. I think he is still in polls relatively popular in the Philippines, but some of his agenda has gotten bogged down, that he's been involved in a long conflict in the southern Philippines. The economic agenda is not going as fast as he would like it. And the drug war, in addition to all the human rights problems, has just tired out and exhausted the police and the army and left them open to being challenged by militants linked to the Islamic State and others. It's just been a huge waste of resources, as well as, you know, a human rights catastrophe. But he is still pretty popular.
And so does the United States have any leverage over the Philippines when it comes to human rights issues?
Sure, the United States has leverage. I mean, I think the Philippines is a U.S. treaty ally, one of the United States' treaty allies in East Asia. The Philippines needs U.S. security assistance for its growing and serious counterterrorism problem. U.S. investment is very important in the Philippines. The Philippines is a fast-growing economy. I mean, there's always going to be a challenge to the relationship because the United States was a colonial power there, and it's going to be complex. But certainly the U.S. has tools of leverage, but the Trump administration has decided it's not interested in utilizing those.
So until further notice, it seems as though the relationship will remain friendly unless, you know, something drastic happens. I mean, and it seems as though certainly among American lawmakers, they don't have a lot of patience for what seems like human rights issues from Duterte. Am I incorrect in assuming that?
Well, I think, first of all, one thing to say is that there's a lot more than just Trump and Duterte. It's a long relationship built on very deep strategic ties, military ties, economic ties, et cetera. It's not all about Trump and Duterte, but making it more about Trump and Duterte, particularly by the two administrations, actually runs the risk that you could have a much more deteriorating relationship. Yes, Duterte insulted President Obama, but President Obama didn't really say very much that really in response. The relationship went on. Duterte has insulted the Pope, but the Pope didn't really respond, and the relationship went on. However, if something was to come up and Duterte insulted Trump over whatever, we don't really know, but Duterte is a very prickly character. It's very unlikely that Trump would just turn the other cheek and let it just go. So actually, you have a problematic situation in which two highly personalistic hair trigger leaders, you actually could have a worse situation than under Duterte and Obama. There is criticism of Duterte and by opposition politicians and others in the Philippines. There is criticism of his human rights record. It just hasn't completely coalesced, I would say, at this point to dent his popularity that much.
And you don't see moving forward anything U.S. policy-wise to maybe try to put that in check the way that we have some lawmakers who would like to see us take a stronger stand on that with this anti-drug campaign that's happening over there?
It's possible. I mean, Congress has historically played a pretty significant role on human rights issues in Southeast Asia, with the Philippines, with Indonesia, with Thailand, Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. So it's possible, but the Philippines is low, I would say, lower down the list of those in Congress who are interested in human rights than some of those other countries. And remember that in some of these other countries in the region, in Myanmar and Cambodia, you have huge human rights problems going on now as well. So it's sort of like, what fire are you going to address first? So I think there are tools that Congress could bring to bear, but I think it's unlikely they will. They're working on Myanmar. There's some bills, possible bills that could come up on Cambodia. Philippines probably fall farther down the list.
Well, Josh, we'll leave it there for right now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Josh Kurlinsik is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joined us today to take a closer look at President Trump's trip to Manila and his seemingly friendly relationship with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte.
Right now, we're taking a look at gender violence here in Wisconsin. 7 months after a multiple shooting incident in the Wausau area, Hmong community leaders are trying to take steps to keep another similar incident from happening. As Glenn Moberg reports, part of that effort involves a controversial new push to change perceived cultural attitudes in the Hmong community.
On March 22nd, Neng Mai Vang, enraged at a pending divorce, killed four people in a half hour's time.
Her husband's trying to kill her, and her husband's at the bank.
Two bank employees, Karen Barkley and Diane Look, were shot helping Vang's wife escape. Diane's husband, Bob Look, is still trying to make sense of it.
My very best friend, and not a better person I've ever met. There will never be peace of mind.
10 minutes later, Vang shot and killed his wife's attorney, Sarah Quartzsand.
Shots fired, officer down.
20 minutes after that, Everest Metro Police Chief Wally Sparks lost his detective, Jason Weiland.
Since 2006, we've had 8 homicides. 6 of those were committed by Hmong men and were domestic related.
Sparks says some Hmong men are plagued by unfortunate old cultural attitudes.
There were 3 individuals arrested that all referenced the March 22nd shooting, 3 Hmong men who threatened to do the exact same thing. When you have 3 people stepping forward and all basically blaming the wife for the killing of 4 innocent people in this community, there's some mindset that needs to be changed.
Cam Tong Yang, former board president of Wausau's Hmong American Center, disputes Chief Sparks' use of statistics.
It's offensive when other ethnic groups point fingers at our cultures. There's over 7,000 Hmong residents in the Wausau area, and those 6 individuals do not reflect our community.
Yang calls them bad apples.
I am angry at those people who commit these crimes and make poor decisions, and it reflects badly on myself and a lot of good Hmong men out there. We love our wives. They are our foundation.
But there are some in the Hmong community who think old cultural attitudes can be a problem.
Anybody helps the victim, they are being blamed.
Mao Kang is a high-ranking Hmong leader in Wisconsin. She also works at the women's community, Wausau's domestic violence shelter.
And domestic violence in the Hmong community is silence. You can't say anything. You can't tell anybody. If you do and anybody try to help you, then somebody's trying to break the marriage.
Kang says while most Hmong men were ashamed, some praised Neng Mai Vang for his murderous rampage.
There's some men that still call him heroes because he has, you know, killed people that's helping victims.
In 2009, before he died, a revered Hmong leader, General Vang Pao, came to Wausau to lecture Hmong clan leaders after a series of domestic violence incidents.
The husband has to respect the wife as he respects himself. Do your best to be a role model. I'm telling you today to stop.
Following his visit, local Hmong leaders put General Pao's message in a handbook calling for equal treatment for women. Chief Sparks says there is a new effort to get the handbook translated so its message takes hold.
What we're really looking for is male leadership within the Hmong community to step up like General Vang Pao did and say, this is wrong.
Cam Tong Yang says he is willing to step forward.
When we see a couple, a husband and wife, where one is abusing the other, we need to stand up for that. We shouldn't hide any of that.
Bob Look says he doesn't blame the Hmong culture for the death of his wife, Diane. He says he is still good friends with the Hmong woman that Neng Mai Vang was stalking and Diane was trying to protect.
In no way, shape, or form do I hold the Hmong community responsible or blame them for the incident. This was one individual, a greedy, selfish individual who created this mess.
Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Now, Kejua Vang is the founder and co-executive director of Freedom Inc., a Madison-based nonprofit that works toward social change within the Southeast Asian and Black communities. Kejua, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kejua, as a member of the Hmong community and as someone who has been working against gender violence in the South Asian community, are there any unique cultural issues that you feel need to be addressed?
So as a longtime domestic violence, sexual assault advocate, gender justice advocate, I feel like domestic violence happens in every community. And, you know, domestic violence is about power and control. It's about violence. And I don't think that any community condones or sees it as part of their culture. And so I feel like when you talk about Hmong culture and how it contributes to domestic violence, you can actually also talk about many other cultures and their cultural practices and how that can also contribute to domestic violence. And so I don't feel like there's anything in particular about my culture that makes it more likely to have domestic violence or less likely to have domestic violence than any other cultures.
Do you feel as though there is, from an outsider perspective, someone who isn't a member of the Hmong community, do you think that there are some misconceptions that maybe it is more prevalent among Hmong women and men, or do you think that that's been kind of blown out of proportion?
I absolutely think that it's blown out of proportion. I think that because we're such a small population, wherever we go, that I think that, you know, one domestic suicide homicide becomes this big deal because it's one, and then you have, you know, maybe 100 Hmong families or a couple thousand Hmong families, whereas you may have in the state of Wisconsin many homicide-suicide within different communities, but it's not in the limelight like it would be for ours.
Sure. And so it sort of feels maybe as though the spotlight is there when the spotlight could be on other communities in the state is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes, like, when people don't understand cultures, it's really easy to say that this practice contributes to this. But misogyny and patriarchy happens in all communities, and it looks very different. And I think that because our cultural practices are quite different from mainstream practices, and so if we're in these smaller towns throughout the state of Wisconsin, I think that it's really easy for people to say, oh, it's because they practice this, and that's why, you know, they devalue Hmong women, and therefore this happens. But if you look in white communities, domestic violence looks very different, but it still happens. And in fact, you know, I think that one of the things that we've been noticing as gender justice advocates is that a lot of these shootings, mass killings throughout the U.S., many of those men, many of those perpetrators actually have a long history of domestic violence. And so it isn't uniquely to Hmong communities.
We're talking to Kajua Va. She is the founder and co-executive director of Freedom, Inc., which works in Black, Cambodian, and Hmong communities to combat domestic violence. And your organization, Freedom, Inc., works with gender violence, domestic violence. What services and support do victims and survivors ask for just in your sort of day-to-day work?
I mean, I think that, like all domestic violence survivors, we work with, here at Freedom Inc., we work with predominantly Black, Cambodian, and Hmong families or folks who are victims and survivors of domestic violence and gender-based violence. And what we've learned is that they basically, I mean, the majority of them want to be safe, want to live a life where they're not experiencing domestic violence or violence every day. And that is something that's not unique to just Hmong victims, but it's unique to all victims. They want the violence to stop, number one. And number two, they want their families and their children to be safe, and they want resources to help them get to safety. And as we all know, it could be housing, it could be medical care, it could be help with their children's education. But these are some basic, like, human needs that people need in order to, like, live away from the violence. And then the other piece that I think people don't talk about is I think that it is this changing of cultural norms, not so much of Hmong traditional culture, but it is about this social norm that has become normalized in all of our communities, and that is the normalizing of violence as a solution.
So, Kajua, in the piece that we heard just a couple of minutes ago, General Vang Pao was quoted he spoke in 2009 about the importance of Hmong husbands treating their wives better. You know, he has a pretty significant role in the Hmong community. What were your reactions to what you just heard from him?
So I think that in all due respect to the late General Vang Pao, I just want folks to understand that though he was a war hero to many in the Hmong community, he was not at all a Hmong feminist or somebody who that stood for women's rights. And so I think that it's important, as we are trying to figure out how to resolve the issues of Hmong men and other men following in the footsteps of the people who abuse and kill, that to use somebody whose voice, we should be uplifting Hmong men who are doing by living who are doing right by living the example that they are speaking. And so, without disrespecting the late general, I just wanted to say that I think that it is important that we use alternative voices, because he was not a Hmong woman's activist, nor was he a feminist, and therefore I think that it's problematic to use his voice as the voice to ask for respect for Hmong women. And it becomes part of the issue of why we haven't been able to create new social norms, is that if these traditions are oppressive, can his voice also become part of that ingrained historical memory of those who have not done right by Hmong women?
Kajua, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kajua Vang is the founder and co-executive director of Freedom, Inc. That's a Madison-based nonprofit that works toward social change within Southeast Asian and Black communities. And she joined us to talk about domestic violence and misconceptions that some cultures might be more prone to intimate partner violence.
It's been just over a year since a dramatic presidential election night here in Wisconsin and around the country. Wisconsin ultimately went to Donald Trump by a narrow margin of just over 20,000 votes.
Our next guest is visiting communities around Wisconsin to talk to voters about their decision and how they feel a year later. He started in a part of the state that's been getting a lot of national attention for its unique politics in recent years, the Driftless region of southwestern Wisconsin.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's a political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's writing an ongoing series on political changes in Wisconsin after the 2016 election. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, you started in southwestern Wisconsin. What makes that region of the state unique politically?
Well, a whole combination of things kind of make it interesting at this moment in time. It's pretty purple, which is unusual for a rural white area. I mean, there aren't most rural white communities and counties in America lean pretty heavily Republican. But if you go back to the recent presidential elections like 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, these counties in southwestern Wisconsin along the upper Mississippi River and the counties just across the river in Minnesota and Iowa voted Democratic, not by a lot, but just the fact that they were as purple and blue-leaning as they are. A lot of them still continue to vote a Republican for local office, but then on top of that, they switched pretty heavily, swung very hard in 2016 from sort of double-digit Obama to single-digit Trump, and the size of the shift was pretty staggering. And so the kind of demographics and how that kind of ties into Trump's base of support last fall and the volatility, I mean, these are swingy voters. In some cases, some real bellwether counties in this region. Richland County in Wisconsin is one of only 19 counties in America that has voted for the presidential winner every time since 1980. So it's just an interesting area politically and demographically, and for this moment in time when people are wondering, what explains, communities and voters that switched from Obama to Trump.
And another interesting thing there, you write, is that it's kind of not politically segregated as we see other regions sorting themselves out into this is the Democratic zone, this is the Republican. There you've got people living next to people and interacting with people who vote differently than they do.
Yeah, and if you've spent a lot of time in southeastern Wisconsin and metropolitan Milwaukee, it's very striking how different it is in that respect, because I did a big project for the paper a few years back about how politically segregated the Milwaukee metro area is, you know, basically the overwhelming majority of voters live in communities that are overwhelmingly blue or red. There's not a lot in between, and it's been getting, and these communities have been diverging politically for decades. You go to southwestern Wisconsin, where you don't have, you know, this big city-suburban divide, because you don't have big cities, for one thing, and you don't have even have big suburbs, but you have, you know, this rural area where, which is unusually purple, and it also means that, you know, Trump voters and Clinton voters are really living side by side. It's really, you know, a very small number of voters that live in overwhelmingly partisan communities, and more than half the communities in this part of the state, more than half, voted for Obama in 2012 and Trump in 2016, and you can't find a single community in the Milwaukee metropolitan area that did that.
And you went to southwestern Wisconsin and talked to people. We'll get to what you learned in just a bit, but you are not alone. It sounds like a lot of people on the national political scene are interested in the Driftless region in Wisconsin and neighboring states, even some international attention, a big Dutch write-up on the area.
Yeah, I mean, there was a Dutch television crew that showed up in Steuben. So Steuben, it turns out, Steuben is a small village. It's like 100 people in Crawford County in southwestern Wisconsin. And it is very small, but in percentage terms, it had the biggest swing from Obama to Trump. I mean, basically, you know, Obama won it by, I think, 38 points, and Trump won it by 35 or vice versa. So that's a swing of more than 70 points, granted a very small community. But there were pretty sizable swings in a lot of small communities. And so the Dutch television crew a few weeks ago showed up in Steuben and spent a lot of time talking to people there. I mean, there's interest. There's certainly a lot of interest, of course, in American politics outside of America, but then in particular in the Midwest, because people understand that it's kind of a pivotal area, and in particular in these states, the blue, so-called blue wall states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, that shifted. And then when you look at an area like the one we've been talking about, it's sort of, I think it's even more interesting for people. There have been, in addition to, you know, German and Dutch television crews and national journalists, there have also been groups, political groups, but also civic groups. I talked to one group called Resetting the Table, which is based in New York, and they specialize in kind of promoting dialogue within the American Jewish community across the divisions over Israel among American Jews. And that's what they do. And so they took that and went into the Driftless area in Wisconsin and just across the state line into some of these other states, and spent a lot of time sitting down with voters sort of promoting discussions across these political lines. I thought that was interesting. There's a lot of that kind of activity going on. And I talked to a lot of voters, not just about, you know, Trump and Clinton and Congress and their frustrations with Washington, but also about just their sort of frustrations with the political culture and, you know, how hard it is to even have a discussion about politics with people that you disagree with.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's started a series where he's going around the state talking to people in different regions about how they voted, how they feel about political changes since the presidential election. You just mentioned Steuben, Craig. I want to bring on a caller. Rana is calling us from Steuben. Rana, hi.
Hi. This is just a really exciting moment for us. Thank you for even saying Steuben and then let alone saying it correctly.
Well, thanks for calling in. I had a great time out there. I hung out at Joe's Country Bar and talked to people over breakfast. In fact, we ran a picture of the bar in our story online. But that whole area is just fascinating politically. It's also physically, you know, beautiful, and it's just interesting on a lot of levels.
It is very challenging. So much of it is rural America, farmed, a bunch of stubborn old bohemians farming up there on those cliffs, so to speak, and it was just really exciting to hear you talk about Steuben and the things that, you know, the feelings that Steuben has about politics and in general. So thanks for putting us on the map for a day.
And Rana, thanks for calling in. I mean, she says that in kind of a lighthearted way, Craig, but I grew up in a town in Michigan that was in the Detroit radio market. I never heard my town mentioned. I heard the governor say the name wrong once. Is this an area that feels overlooked by politicians and the media?
Yeah, there's some of that, although, you know, it hasn't always been overlooked. I mean, if you look, it was certainly overlooked in this campaign, certainly by the Clinton campaign. But, You go back to, I think, one of the lessons. I mean, one thing I heard from a lot of people, this election was just as much about, you know, the resistance and negative perceptions people had toward Hillary Clinton in places like this as it was, you know, the appeal that Donald Trump had. I mean, a lot of people ended up voting for Donald Trump that had major qualms about Donald Trump, that didn't necessarily like Donald Trump, but they, a lot of these people were people that just couldn't bring themselves to vote for Hillary Clinton. And so she was in that sense kind of an ill fit for the area, but also the combination of that and the fact that there was no effort. I mean, if you go back, I kept thinking going back to spending time in 2000 and 2004 on the campaign trail, in this very part of the state. I mean, Al Gore took a riverboat ride down the Mississippi and hit these counties. John Kerry crisscrossed the area in a bus, as did George W. Bush in 2004, paid tremendous attention to western Wisconsin and southwestern Wisconsin. So it's a combination of, but they were also accused and perceived, like Hillary Clinton was, Gore and Kerry in this case, as being people, candidates that didn't necessarily, quote, connect with rural voters in the heartland, yet they put in the time and made the effort and worked it. And they ended up winning incredibly narrow elections in Wisconsin, certainly in part because they won some of these rural southwestern counties. I mean, the election's decided by a few thousand votes, as was this one. So that's, you know, those are some of the takeaways. So they haven't always been ignored politically, certainly a lot of, you know, many people who live there feel, you know, the economic struggles, and some people feel like they're overlooked by people in the more populous areas. That's certainly true.
Craig Gilbert is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's writing a series on Wisconsin voters 1 year after election 2016. His first piece in that series takes us to the driftless region of southwestern Wisconsin.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. If you live in the driftless region, how would you describe the politics of your area? How did you vote? And how do you feel about that vote 1 year later? And for anyone in the state, has the last year made you change your mind or reinforced your decision on the presidential race? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with political reporter Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's on the road talking to voters around the state about the 2016 election and how politics have changed since then.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Craig started in southwestern Wisconsin. If you're from there, tell us what politics are like in your community and wherever you are in the state. Are you looking back at how you voted in 2016, glad of that decision, regretting it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. And Craig, that's something you talk to people a lot about in southwestern Wisconsin, how they felt about their decision in last year's election. What kind of things did you hear? Let's start with Trump voters.
Well, I think you really have to say there's a spectrum of Trump voters. There are the kind of, you know, hardcore Trump voters, people that were very enthusiastic about their choice, that remain enthusiastic. They kind of like his agenda. They really like his style, and they still feel that way. Then there are, I think there's a lot of sort of traditional Republicans, people that typically vote Republican, that are more partisan, that Trump was never their first choice, or in some cases even their second or third choice in the primaries, but they kind of fell into line when he was their party's nominee. And while they may have qualms about his style and personality and maybe even some of his positions or some of the things he says and does, they still want to see the Republican agenda advance. And then you have, I would say, I talked to a lot of people that were really kind of vocally independent. They really stressed the fact that they didn't feel affiliated with either party. They saw themselves in sort of the very broad middle, even though they might lean left or lean right. And they voted for Trump for a combination of reasons. Some of them we've talked about, not liking Hillary Clinton, just being so frustrated with the political process that they were going to vote for, you know, the shake-up candidate, or maybe, elements of economic frustration. Maybe they like Trump's emphasis on on kind of America First. Maybe they had strong feelings on trade and immigration. Maybe they were, you know, they liked his defiance of political correctness. But these people are conflicted, and you know, some of them are not necessarily shocked by the way Trump has kind of conducted himself in office, but they're frustrated. They just don't like the tweets. They just are either just sort of resigned to it or really exasperated by it, and they're also frustrated by a sense that, you know, nothing is coming out of Washington, and they're kind of frustrated by the fact that the parties never do anything together. So those are the people, I think, that are really interesting to watch and going to be interesting to watch going forward, because we know that there are swing voters out there, and in a place like southwestern Wisconsin, there are proportionately a lot of them. I mean, one thing about rural voters in Wisconsin in general is that they swing more than the rest of the state. The partisan shifts from election to election are bigger, and that's certainly true of this area. I mean, you had when there was this big swing in 2008 from the 2004 election to the 2008 election in a Democratic direction for Obama, the swing was bigger in southwestern Wisconsin than it was statewide. And then when you had this swing toward Trump from, you know, the 2012 vote to the 2016 vote, the swing was far bigger than it was in the rest of the state. I mean, basically there was a 7-point swing or 7 or 8-point swing statewide, but there was like a 20-point swing in southwestern Wisconsin. So that's a reflection of how independent these voters are in terms of not being party loyalists, and also the sort of frustration and the desire for change as well. And that's going forward an interesting combination, because they could, you can certainly imagine them swinging back if they don't like the way things play out. And so we're going to get some clues in 2018 and some big clues, even bigger clues in 2020 about that.
And what did you hear from people who said they'd voted for Hillary Clinton last year?
Well, a lot of those people are just, you know, almost apoplectic. I mean, they're just really appalled by Trump as they were then. And some of them are demoralized because they feel like, you know, his behavior is being, quote, normalized, unquote. Some of them are, you know, mobilized to some degree, but and waiting for kind of opportunities. I'm sure some of them are invigorated by the results in the most recent elections in Virginia and New Jersey. Although when I was doing my reporting, it was right before that election day. But some of them are also, you know, they also do share the broader frustration that I mentioned with the political climate and the political culture. So that was something that you heard across the board.
We are talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, talking about Wisconsin voters 1 year out from Election Day. He's touring the state a little bit at a time. He started in southwestern Wisconsin to see what people thought 1 year after the election and most of a year into a Donald Trump presidency. And Craig, let's talk some more about that frustration with the political system. It sounds like that applies to politicians, most of them, the political parties, the news media, kind of across the board frustration. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because, you know, here's one example. I mean, I talked to people who were very frustrated with Trump's tweets and his behavior, including people that had voted for him. But they were also frustrated because they thought, you know, that the coverage of it was overblown and that there was almost a fixation daily on his rhetoric. They not only didn't want to see Trump saying the things he was saying, but they didn't want to see the attention paid to it that was being paid to it. And so yes, there's criticism of the media. Some people feel like the media could be playing a more constructive role in kind of lowering the temperature instead of raising the temperature. There's frustration, again, I think I mentioned before, with just the sort of failure of the parties to ever agree on anything or act in concert or compromise. So that's a frustration. And people are, you know, they're frustrated with the, in some cases, just the political encounters they have with each other, and the fact that sometimes it gets ugly and sometimes, you either have to decide kind of to steer clear of the subject or steer clear of the person who lives next to you or the family member, either when it comes to politics or when it comes to anything. I mean, there's some element of that, too. So that's something that I think a lot of people across the board are struggling with, but I think it takes on a different complexion in an area like this where people aren't as physically separated from each other by their politics. So, in other words, it could be the person, you know, right, you could be your neighbor who who you can't talk about politics with because you disagree on things, whereas...
I want to jump in, Craig, and bring on one more caller. We've got Steve on the line in Danbury. Steve, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I live right here in the heart of Trump country in rural northwestern Wisconsin, and our indivisible group held a forum called Northwest Wisconsin Speaks a couple months back, and we heard from a lot of people, and what you found out is there's a lot of misinformation out there. People were confused about the difference between, for example, the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, and in our congressional district, where we have a Republican representative, we also have the highest raw number of people on the Affordable Care Act subsidies. So in essence, they were voting against their interest, and a lot of people have been surprised here during the health care debate to find out that they will be affected in a negative way.
Gotcha, Steve. And Craig, did you hear that kind of talk about issues, how people view, Obamacare repeal?
Yeah, I mean, health care is a really interesting one because, it's very divisive. And so people are more polarized over health care. But at the same time, you talk to voters. I talk to voters who describe themselves as limited government conservatives who were upset by the House Republican health care bill because they didn't want to see the changes made to guaranteed coverage for pre-existing conditions that were contained in that bill. So these things, sometimes cross lines, and you have people that are cross-pressured. I mean, one interesting thing that I heard in this area is obviously agriculture is a huge part of the economy and dairy is a big part of the economic foundation of southwestern Wisconsin. But at the same time, you have a lot of households, not that many households rely purely on agriculture because people need health care. So one member of the household may be a nurse or maybe in manufacturing, and the other one may be a farmer. And within households, those economic interests can pull in different directions. If you just think about issues like trade and immigration, where a lot of people in the agricultural community are pro-trade and pro-immigration because they see it as promoting agriculture and their exports. Whereas, if you're a factory worker or if you've lost a factory job, you may be blaming trade for that and may be pulled in the other direction. So there are a lot of cross pressures within communities and even within households.
And Craig, as we wrap up briefly, you started in southwestern Wisconsin. What will your next piece tackle?
I'm actually going to spend some time this week in Paul Ryan's 1st Congressional District, so southeast Wisconsin, very different complexion politically. We've talked about some of the differences. And talking to people about Congress, about the Speaker, and you've got certainly attitudes toward Trump playing a role when it comes to people's perceptions of Paul Ryan. You've got attitudes toward Congress. You've got a tax bill that may or may not pass, that may pass in the House and may not pass in the Senate. You've got Foxconn in this district. There's a lot of things going on. And so I thought it would be interesting to spend some time in this part of the state.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime.
That's Craig Gilbert, political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's writing an ongoing series on political changes in Wisconsin after the 2016 election. We have a link to the first piece looking at southwestern Wisconsin on the Ideas Network Facebook page or at WPR.org.
So the Lord of the Ring movies were a big hit, and now it looks like there will be another effort to bring the world of Middle-earth to life on a screen.
Amazon announced today that's going to create a multi-season TV series set as a prequel to The Fellowship of the Ring.
But it's not The Hobbit, apparently, which was actually already a prequel to The Fellowship of the Ring.
So I guess they're going to pick up other stories, other threads, like what the dwarves and elves and humans were up to
yeah.
while The Hobbit was going on?
I don't know.
They're not clear on this.
It wasn't clear. It was just enough of, we've had some, tantalizing new movies thrown out there. Like, we have the new Star Wars movie series that's coming out, not affiliated with this one, where they throw it out to tease us, but they don't give us a lot of details.
You're going to watch no matter what, it sounds like, probably.
Yeah, of course I am.
And I think they should try some new twists on the genre, like, you know, a comedy.
Yeah, sure.
Or a buddy comedy.
A funny Lord of the Rings. I would watch that.
Police procedural.
Just a day-to-day
or Cops, Mordor. See, right? You could really take it in a lot of new directions.
See how orcs work and all that and all... Who knows?
Right.
Who knows what would happen?
You're going to watch it no matter
what.
Yeah,
I'm going to watch it, so...
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.